And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to the community in Hamilton and beyond, and the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And of course, we have a real treat today. We're going to be speaking with Mike Whitney. He is a commentator on economic issues, writes for Counterpunch and other publications. He lives in Washington State, and he's a contributor to Hopeless, Barack Obama, and the Politics of Illusion from AK Press. And I believe we have him on the line now. Hi, Mike. Are you with us today?
Brendan, how are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great. Listener demand is high for this kind of commentary. I think people are getting tired of the talking heads. We've heard too much. The truth is, you've been a kind of shadow stats for the housing market. You've been using terms like depression, stagnation, before the corporate media started to glom onto it, even just a couple weeks ago. So there's a lot of issues up in the air right now, and a lot of skepticism. People are getting tired of certain phrases. They're talking about the risk of another recession, the idea that we're in a double dip situation and there could be another downturn. But from what I'm getting from your reporting on this, did we even really leave the recession in the first place?
You know, it's interesting you should mention that, because there was a survey just recently, and something like in the neighborhood of about 80% of the people believe we're still in a recession. So what is a recession? You know, in technical terms, it's two quarters of negative growth. But, you know, there's the perception factor, too, and confidence has never been restored. And, in my thinking, I would call this more of a depression, because we're just not getting back to where we were. We still have a huge output gap. We have very high unemployment, and the unemployment, as you know, that goes unreported because so many people are falling off the unemployment rolls, is at minimum 11%, and the underemployment is something in the neighborhood of 16%. So we have probably 12 million people unemployed, and the people who are going back to work, as you also know, are going back at really low-end, low-paying service jobs. So they're making, you know, presumably about half of what they made before. So all this is really, detrimental to the economy, and has slowed consumer spending and, affected just general activity.
Well, there's words being tossed about like green shoots, turnaround, spring, and there is an attempt to make us feel as if the economy is turning around. I think your thoughts, your view and perspective on this matter is shared by most Americans and Canadians. When they talk about recovery, as you're pointing out, it doesn't really feel like one. If people are getting jobs that did not pay as much as before, that's one factor, but it feels like when they talk about stocks and the stock market and recovery, it's not the same as what Main Street is experiencing.
Well, if you look at what's happening in the United States and you look at happening in Europe, there are great similarities that are interesting in the context of this conversation. One being that you're probably familiar with the phrase starve the beast, and that's the far-right mantra of the way that you reduce government spending is not by pushing policy through the Congress, because it becomes impossible, because everyone has their own pet programs that they want to keep in place. So what you do is you cut off the blood flow to government, and you do that by creating a debt crisis or a situation where government cannot get the money that it needs. Now, in Europe, there's a dramatic situation where basically the only resource, they cannot get any counter-cyclical fiscal stimulus because there's no central government to issue that. So basically the sustained depression in the South, in Spain and Italy and Greece and blah, blah, blah. But the same tactics are being used in a more moderate form in the United States. The, for example, one of the President Obama's leading economic advisors, along with Lawrence Summers, was Christina Romer. Now, she suggested or recommended that we put in place $1.8 trillion for the original stimulus. As it turned out, we did less than half of that. We did like $800 billion. So there was never any intention to completely get the economy kick-started and revved up to full capacity. What they wanted to do was to keep the economy from completely rolling over the cliff, but to starve the government of as much money so that we could reduce the programs and put pressure on the basically entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. And that's what's happening right now, right? I think it's happening in Canada as well.
Yes, austerity. It's the buzzword all around, as you pointed out. I think starve the beast, very much part of Reaganism and the last 30 or 40 years of economic policy, it's come to its fullest fruition now, I think.
I think so, too.
One of the aspects here is that, as you're pointing out, the government is seen as slow, sluggish, responsive to too many interests. So banks are being entrusted with a caretaking role here. And I think a major theme in your articles, and I think you've written about 10 in the last 2 months, is that the manner in which government intervenes in the economy, especially in the United States, is very uneven. So as you've pointed out, the stimulus has been half of what was perhaps expected, but certain things are being juiced. For example, the stock market. And when we talk about stocks going up or how certain indexes are performing, a large portion of that is the direct result of government funding.
Oh, absolutely. If you look at the graph, and there's a graph today on Economist View, which points out, I mean, one picture is worth a thousand words. When you see the trajectory of the stock market in relation to quantitative easing 1, quantitative easing 2, and Operation Twist, the three main injections of hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of Fed liquidity from the Federal Reserve, then you can see that at each interval when that liquidity was pumped into the market, the stocks went up. Okay, so naturally, the only conclusion you can draw from that is that the markets are being juiced. And the Fed Chair Bernanke hasn't even backed away from that. He has said in at least two presentations before Congress that he feels like one of the successes of the quantitative easing program is that, in his words, risk assets, which means stocks, have gone up. Okay, so here you have someone who is using the benchmark of stock prices or asset price inflation as a sign of success. So I don't think we should be surprised that the market is pumped up.
Yes.
But at the same time, I mean, if we look at the stock market and we say, in the three-year period since March 9th, when the recession formally ended, 2009, to now, we see that the Dow Jones and the S&P have more than doubled. At the same time, consumer spending, incomes, consumer borrowing, et cetera, have only increased very marginally, 3, 4, 5, 6% in relation to the stocks, which have more than doubled. So how do you have that? How do you have, you know, risk assets doubling at the same time the real economy is still stuck in the mud?
Well, I get the feeling from your articles that the stock market at present is very much a disastrous rigged game. The small investors, mom-and-pop investors, have been burned too many times. As you pointed out, they were burned in the 2000 dot-com crash. They were burned in the 2008 crash. They don't have the money to put back into the stock market. Most of the major transactions are done very quickly by supercomputers, one group of traders using a supercomputer to take advantage of very minute differences. So it's not a place where you can supplement your meager earnings anymore.
You know, if you look at, if you read Barron's and Forbes and all these industry magazines that I do, and they keep pumping the stock market, keep pumping equities, get back in, you missed this great surge of equities which doubled in the last, you know, you guys missed it, you don't want to miss the next 3 years because it's going to double again. And every single week, if you follow the ICI reports, people, mom and pop, you and I, you know, just normal working people, 3.5 years after Lehman Brothers failed and the stock market collapsed, people are still withdrawing their money, their pensions, their savings, everything out of equities funds. And they are putting their money in bond funds, in the more conservative bond funds. But those things, bonds only move marginally, so it doesn't really create an adequate buffer for if you have, your retirement plans are depending on, the uptick in the market. But still, the distrust is so great that, people just do not have the confidence in our institutions as a whole and in the stock market in particular.
Well, think about where the returns are coming from. Anyone who has the resources to monitor the market and monitor the actions of the government knows that the big money in investments in the stock market comes once there's been a massive injection of liquidity by the government. So that's how you make your income. Otherwise, people have fled to the low-return treasuries, as you've pointed out. It's not even clear how long they may remain there. You've pointed out that ordinary investors have moved out and are just putting money into their bank accounts and other forms because they're scared of what might happen to it otherwise.
Yeah, it's still, again, it's still the name of the game is capital preservation and not profit-making. But there is an interesting subtext to this, and that's the fact that this Operation Twist, which is the basically the quantitative easing program that's that the Fed is engaged in right now, it's $400 billion of buying long-term bonds with short-term bonds. So there's a little bit of a shell game thing going on here. But that does not end until mid-June, okay? So now the stocks for the last 3 years, 2 years in a row, and this will be the third year, have started their decline in May. So why would that be if the Fed is still pumping up the stock market that they decline a full 2 months earlier? And the reason is because the stocks are stock prices are based on expectations of what the profits will be and earnings, et cetera. So people are already, if they don't see any sign from the Federal Reserve that they're going to start keep pumping money into the markets, people gradually begin to withdraw. And that, coupled with other disasters like what's going on in Europe and Spain and Greece right now, are increasing the downward pressure on stocks.
Well, indeed, if we're talking about animal spirits, they're certainly not ones about maximization, getting out there, getting what you need. It's not very much of a carnivorous wealth-gaining process going on right now. I think you mentioned, again, the situation in Europe and how it's reflected in the United States and quite possibly Canada. Now, when we talk about these austerity policies, starve the beast and so forth, we know that governments have been reducing the payrolls, reducing the number of public servants, reducing entitlement programs and so forth, which means, of course, less money in people's pockets, fewer jobs. That's going to undermine people's confidence, and it's going to destroy aggregate demand, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think the term animal spirits is sometimes taken out of context, and I'm not saying that in regard to what you said, but if you read Keynes on animal spirits, animal spirits is something that comes, you see, in Keynes' worldview, man is naturally a fearful being, okay? And so the institutions and the safety provisions have to be put in place for people to really put their assets or put their take the risks that are necessary to move the stock market upward. So the Fed's job in respect to Keynes is essentially to create a context or an environment where people feel that there's enough stability that they're willing to look at these individual stocks and individual issues and place their hard-earned money. Now, I ask you, rhetorically, whether you think that the Fed has created that kind of environment, or with the high-speed or high-frequency trading and all of the derivatives trades and the speculation going on in the oil and commodities markets, whether this seems like the most risky market in the history of stocks. I think people feel that way. They feel naturally reticent and very skittish about going in at all.
Yes, some of the indicators are the worst ever seen, as you've pointed out. One group that is being protected, of course, our banks. You know, you've talked about shell games. I think one of the biggest is the mortgage situation and the housing situation in general. There have been attempts to say that the housing market is finally turning around, that prices that may start to climb again, that the decline will slow down. But the truth is, and you've been very diligent on this issue, of course, is that there's an enormous supply of housing right now. And the banks have been trying to hide it as much as possible. There have been people who have been unable to pay their mortgages who remain in their homes, and not a lot of attention has been drawn to that particular situation. So what we have right now are banks trying to, and others trying to unload their investment in housing very slowly, a very slow trickle.
See, I'd like to talk about this for a few minutes because I'm confused about it, okay? I know as well as anyone what the facts are, but there are also an awful lot of people who are on the opposite side of this issue who I have a great deal of confidence and I've read for years, like Calculated Risk, the number one economics blog in the world. Bill McBride says that we've hit a bottom in housing. But his calculations, along with Ivy Zelman and Mark Zandi and other very reputable people in the business who have watched this and monitored the housing collapse for years and years, say that we've hit a bottom. As a matter of fact, a story came out on Bloomberg just a few hours ago, you can still find it there, that housing prices turned around in the last quarter. Now, we need to really examine this closely, because here are the facts. Their calculations are made by looking at existing inventory, okay, which is quite low. It's like about 1.4, 1.5 million homes on the existing inventory. Now, in the immediate shadow inventory, we have about 1.6 homes, so you can double that inventory. But what we know from other analysts like Lori Goodman and just a number of other people who have examined this very closely, the number of homes, as a matter of fact, for a conservative estimate by Bank of America in a recent report, said that they expect in the next couple of years 6.3 million homes to be coming on the market, distressed homes. So you're talking about short sales, foreclosures, et cetera, et cetera. So how is there this huge discrepancy between the people who say that there's only 1.5 million homes out there and the people who say that there's between 8 to 10 million homes that are going to be dumped on the market in the next few years? And the reason is because the banks are colluding among themselves and withholding supply. If you reduce supply, what happens to prices? Prices go up, okay? In our market in Snohomish right here, they have reduced supply in the last year by 30%. There are 30% fewer homes. So naturally, some of the homes are having multiple bids, and this is creating an atmosphere of enthusiasm among the realtors who are saying, like, wow, look at this, man. This thing is really going nuts again. Maybe we're in another upswing. But the reality is that there's X number of buyers, and if there's fewer homes, that's going to push the prices up. So what's the end game for the banks? When are they going to release this huge backlog? I don't know, because keep in mind that the banks do not have to accurately report the losses on the loans that they have, the mortgages that they carry. They only have to report the loss when they finally sell the house. Now, this is just accounting shenanigans, I know, but it does mean that the banks can probably hang on for a very long time without having to put those homes on the market.
Yes,
how does this end? That's my question to everyone listening to this. How does this game end?
It can get much lower than it is in that market. There's certainly a good degree of economic planning being conducted by the banks, and these kind of accounting delays are crucial to the U.S. economy in more than one sector. As far as what's happening with housing and the supply, kind of reminds me of how certain electronics manufacturers will produce very limited runs of the opening of certain products so that they can be sold out.
Exactly, exactly. But one interesting thing is that in housing in America, housing prices have dipped between 34% to 35%. In Ireland, where they didn't have any manipulation or intervention by the banks or their central bank, prices went down between 60% to 65%. So what is the bottom for the U.S. housing prices if the central bank and the other banks were to step back and let these prices fall and just dump their inventory into the market? I think we'd see the same thing.
You have indeed explored how U.S. housing prices could fall in a similar fashion. I think one of the things I appreciate very much about your recent articles is that you have explored both sides of the issue. You have quoted those analysts who you highly respect so that we can see the discussion, we can get a sense of what the issues are and what the arguments are. And I see you're still hashing this out and you're going to be giving regular updates on this. I certainly appreciate that. Perhaps some of your titles or subtitles have contributed to Alexander Coburn's tumbrel. I think you were speaking once again about the new normal in the markets.
And yeah.
I'm guilty of using such phraseology myself. But it's a nice interplay going on in Counterpunch and how some of the articles and discussions may relate to one another. Now, austerity is a big issue being discussed broadly right now, and we've touched upon it a number of times. But what concerns me also is that certainly there are these plans to cut spending, and there's a reaction against that in parts of Europe right now and in parts of North America. How do pro-austerity governments, how do these starve-the-beast politicians justify what they're doing? Is there a basis, an example to which they can state their following?
Well, I think, for example, the head of the ECB, the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, who was formerly a managing director for Goldman Sachs, I think he honestly believed that by handing over 1 trillion euros to the banks that were struggling, that he would pretty well take care of their funding problems, and he would be able to jumpstart credit expansion in Europe again, and to create enough money so that they'd buy the bonds from Italy and Spain and keep their cost low, that says he could refinance or roll over their debts. That hasn't happened. 2 months later, we see that already the credit crisis is emerging, that even though the banks have been hoarding their money at the European Central Bank, they are not lending it out to businesses and they are not lending it out to consumers. So we have the onset of a very serious credit crisis over there. At the same time, the Spanish authorities just bailed out a very big bank today, Bankia, and they're providing resources for that. And this is just the top tip of the iceberg for Spain. They have a long way to go to take care of their huge banking collapse situation, which is the result of their housing bubble. But, you know, I think they believe that if, remember, the government, the person who is printing the money at this point, the European Central Bank, has great sway over government policy because, you know, like Italy and France or Italy and Spain, if their bond yields go up, then they can't finance operations. So if the ECB says jump, they say how high, because they have to follow their instructions. So this is the effect of the debt crisis, is that essentially you have bankers dictating policy. So that is really the main sovereignty compromising effect of austerity. The problem with that is that even though they are in control, unless they have the ECB is in control, they don't have any authority to provide fiscal support for these countries that are in distress. So if they do not provide some sort of fiscal support, the countries in the South are going to stay in this long-term depression and carry the rest of the world along with it.
Yes.
So that's what I see as the main obstacle. And with the election of there was an article today in the New York Times about François Hollande, the new socialist candidate who was just elected president in France. And oddly enough, the White House has thrown their support behind him, even though they were on very friendly terms with Nicolas Sarkozy. And the reason is because the United States wants to see Europe adopt a similar... It gets back up. Most of the southern states are headed for the ditch, and they don't know how they're going to get out of this, but it's accelerating at a very rapid pace.
Wow. We had a little phone glitch there. I missed some of that. But certainly, the sense I'm getting is that the political structures in France, of course, have to work with the structures of the European Union. Their ability to make decisions is more limited than perhaps a North American country might experience. I know it's just about time to go. In terms of these austerity policies and the effect on Main Street, we have the mom-and-pop investors. Even when lending is made easy, for example, there's still non-participation in the stock markets and other issues. You've pointed out, reflecting Henry C.K. Liu, that income is key. Income is everything. And it's easy to see how without aggregate demand, without investor and without citizen confidence, it's very difficult to get out of an economic rut.
Absolutely. And the only reason that we're seeing an uptick in credit right now is the reason there's so much emphasis on credit, as you know, is because there is no basic increase in incomes. They've been flatlining for 10 or 20 years. So they look for credit expansion to make up for that additional spending to keep to increase activity and to grow the economy. But that is only happening in a very limited capacity, in a very dangerous capacity, because where do we see the expansion in credit? In student loans, which are over $1 trillion and are just a huge bubble that's ready to create a huge disaster, and in subprime auto loans, which is if you extend the term of the loan and reduce the standards so that now they're lending to people who have very low FICO scores, you know, 700 should be the baseline, and they're lending to people who are around 500. So, again, you're lending to people who are a serious credit risk, and so, again, the banks are not going to get full remuneration or payback from these loans they're issuing, but they don't care because they're turning them into a different product line, packaging them and selling them to investors who are starved for yield. So that's what's happening there, and it's not a positive development at all. I don't look at it, but you know, once again, you know, you can predict gloom and doom, but these things have a way of stretching out for a very long time before the whole thing blows up.
Yes, very much a characteristic of modern-day America. And with the $1 trillion of student debt, for example, you've pointed out how the United States government is only too happy to create another support another series of very bad investments. I think you've highlighted, we've both highlighted some of the key issues that have been explored in your recent articles. It's very exciting and very interesting to read. We can catch them at www.counterpunch.org, for example. And your recent series of articles goes back through April, part of March, easy to access. And of course, people should be looking at other forms of writing where you can be accessed. I again would mention Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion, to which you have contributed. A lot people can do, and I think once we face reality and face what's actually happening, it's much easier to deal with the crisis. So we should be paying more attention to the issues you've highlighted. Mike, thanks so much for giving us your time today.
Oh, thanks for letting me have this platform, Brendan. I appreciate it. I love talking with you again. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Mike. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Of course, again, that is Mike Whitney, contributor to Counterpunch, other publications. He lives in Washington State, and you should pick up Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion from AK Press. Very easy to access Mike's recent articles. Again, it's at Counterpunch. It's been running great articles for the last 3 weeks or so. I think they were gearing up for May Day and the spring and so forth. And the quality of these articles, it's the best it's been in a long time. And that's saying something. I read it every day, and I read Mike's articles. Again, there's been a dozen to choose from in the last few months. So thanks again, Mike. I know our listeners appreciate this very much. We'll be right back.